You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Chris Hobie is an associate professor at NYU in the Digital Media Design Learning, Educational Communications and Technology Group, and leads a lab called the Dolce Lab, which I've had the pleasure of being walked through the different elements of that name and where each element comes from. It was sort of a first point of thoughtfulness, I think, on Chris's work. One of the reasons I wanted to invite Chris in to talk to a Berkman crowd is specifically, I think, his different take on how to think about people in relation to technologies. And there's sort of been this tradition of human-computer interaction that sort of, you know, thought about modeling the user, and we've thought about that as a way of working and understanding people. But there's an emerging and sort of, I think, getting increasingly helpfully complicated way of understanding people, not just as individuals that we model, but as people who are embedded in a whole bunch of different social relations, a whole bunch of different histories, cultures, and the way that they come to their experiences with technology both sort of supports and reflects those kinds of backgrounds that they have. So this is I think it's a creative and wonderful sort of next step in understanding what we need when we talk about people and technology. And I had the pleasure of seeing a similar talk to this a few weeks ago, so I'm excited to see it again. Oh, and I should also say, Chris was saying that he's happy with people interrupting with questions and asking for clarifications and to sort of make it as conversational as possible.
Yeah.
Jump in.
And following on the success of the last talk, before, I have tried very hard not to fill slides with words. So I'm going to try and show you guys pictures to get us started. But some words that I did want to put on the screen first are just some acknowledgments for some of the people who supported this work. A lot of what I'm doing has been supported by the National Science Foundation or Fulbright. But more actually from in-kind contributions from groups that I've worked with in India, Nepal, Bhutan, and Ghana, some of which are listed here. I also wanted to highlight more recent support from the NYU Information Futures Project, which is a joint project between the NYU libraries and our program in educational technology. We hope that you at Berkman will have heard of us more and more over time. We've certainly been studying the Berkman model as a way to get things going. So some really exciting stuff coming out of that soon. So those of you who got the announcement ahead of time, there was a mention in the abstract about this idea of sort of ecologies of design and technology, and I wanted to say a few words about sustainability, and to maybe focus us in, I want to show you this picture. Tell me what you see.
Trees.
Scattered trees. Is this a good or a bad picture?
Good.
Beautiful.
Good, beautiful.
The trees look like they're artificially planted, so it's good, but if it's cut down from original forest, it's probably bad.
So if it's planted, it might be bad as
not
contrasted?
As good as the original.
As original, okay. Other observations?
It's a terrace.
It's a terrace? What was that? There's moss, there's sort of ground cover.
But there's no undergrowth.
There's no undergrowth. Good observation.
No clouds.
No clouds on this particular day. This is a picture from a region in northern India where I do some work called Uttarakhand, which is west of Nepal and north of Uttar Pradesh. And this is a picture of why girls in this region don't go to school. Why is that? Well, these trees are locally called Norway pine. I have had conflicting advice from PhD botanists about whether they are, in fact, Norwegian pine that's an imported species. But what is clear is that they were planted by the British when the British were trying to make this into a paper-producing region. And the pine trees are really successful. I'm not sure these trees were actually planted. They may have spread. But what you're looking at is a monoculture forest in which there's very little undergrowth. There are these beautiful trees, and they, like I said, they succeed. right? That's why the picture is so pretty. The trees are green and they're thriving. But you go to this forest and you don't hear any birds. And more importantly, for the local population, this displaces the normal mixed oak forest, which is where a lot of the local communities gather fodder for their cows. So broadleaf plant material to feed to the cows. And a group that I work with in this region, the Uttarakhand Sevaniri Paryavaran Shiksha Sanstan, or the Uttarakhand Environmental Education Center, those of you who are Hindi speakers in the room, please forgive me. They did a really interesting study about girls' education and did this beautiful regression, and they put in all the variables that you would normally expect to see that had been documented in the literature as reasons that girls might not go to school: caste, family income, parental attitudes, a whole bunch of stuff. And the factor that sort of dominated everything else was distance of the home to sources of water and fodder. Right? So if somebody has to schlep branches to feed the cows, it'll be the girls, and they'll send them off, and they might have to walk a couple hours. And then they don't really have time to go to school. So, you know, in the sense of environment, and in particular, going back to that word sustainability, there's an awful lot of connectedness that's not apparent. And so being able to understand how these things are connected is a really important thing. Obviously not a new problem in the environmental space. We'll introduce this to kill that pest that was introduced. Oh, that's a disaster. We'll introduce this, and then that'll make, these secondary, tertiary effects are hard to predict. This is a picture, a little context for that forest. So that's an area in Uttarakhand. And you can see things. Somebody pointed out that land had been terraced. And so this is an area where most communities rely on subsistence agriculture, and subsistence agriculture in this mountainous area requires terracing. There's a limited form of slash and burn practiced, which is actually pretty sustainable if the population doesn't get too high, but population is growing. And there's some deforestation problems, and that's for a variety of reasons, not least of which is that wood is a good way to get money. And if you're suddenly participating in an economic system that requires money where before you weren't, then you may draw on resources in a way that may or may not be sustainable. So back to technology. The reason I went to Uttarakhand in the first place was that they had a really innovative program that I wanted to learn about. The government had decided to put computers in all the schools. And just a word about my background. I'm trained as a cognitive scientist, as an educator, as an information scientist. I'm not trained in policy. I'm not trained in international development. I'm also not trained in ecology. So a lot of what I'm telling you is based on me bootstrapping myself. You may very well be more expert than me in many of these things that I'm telling you about, but I'll tell you my stories. What you see on the left is a brand new computer lab in one of these schools in Uttaranchal, in Uttarakhand. And they were very proud of the facility. The question is, what happened to these labs? And in this particular school that you see on the left, the state had provided the computers at a cost of several $1,000s per school and statewide. And this, in Indian context, that is a tremendous achievement. Just the fact that they were able to push that out, incredible. This particular school is about 20 minutes, half an hour from the road on foot. There was no power in this village. The state sent a generator. The petrol for that generator had to be brought in cans on someone's back or on a mule. And so you had the state providing all this hardware and some teacher training. But the school was telling me they had to really cough up a lot of money to support the lab as well. And we figured out that the cost of the hardware, it's about six new computers, was on the order, it was several $1,000s, and it was on the order of one full-time equivalent of their staff, right? So the cost of a teacher per year was what the state had donated in terms of hardware this one time. But the school had to donate like three-quarters of an FTE in terms of getting
outlets installed, putting, you know, getting a room where there was enough security that they could lock it up in a way that they hadn't had to in this building previously, furniture. You know, there were real draws on this. And on the right, you see the kind of use of the technologies that that we observed in the area, where kids were, I mean, this is actually a pretty progressive use on the right. There's a kid driving a CD-ROM game, no internet. There's a kid driving a CD-ROM game and a bunch of other kids watching, but what would be more typical, and in fact the model they used in the school on the left, was formal instruction in things like PowerPoint. Fifth grade, you learn word processing, the teacher demonstrates how to format paragraphs, everybody sits and watches, and then the kids take a paper and pencil test on it. You know, basic office skills were the curriculum. And this school asked the community to donate some money to help run the computer program. So the parents who are sending their kids to school in this area are already committed to education because their kids are there. And there are expenses associated with that. The parents have to help pay for textbooks. They're subsidized, but there's still some expense. A couple hundred rupees a year probably for books, uniforms. And they asked the parents for 10 rupees per year per kid for the gas for the generator. 10 rupees is, you know, like a quarter. And the parents said, nothing doing. Nothing doing. You are training our children to grow up and move to the city and be drunkards and to forget their families. We want no part of your technology education. Right? And the teachers in the school were like, oh, well, you know, these parents, they're ignorant, they don't know what's good for them. And, you know, there was really a failure to appreciate the whole idea that for the towns and communities, sustainability meant, in part, sustaining local culture, making it economically sustainable to remain in the village. Many of these villages have tremendous out-migration of men, a lot of cultural damage, family structure damage because of, you know, the exodus of working-age men. They didn't see how this would help them with things that they valued. And the school wasn't really interested in hearing that message. The point of this story, it's partly a cautionary tale to say, okay, technology might not always be good. But it's also to say that, again, there are these dependencies and relationships, entailments that really can cause a lot of problems. And you say, well, but computers can be a really good thing, right? In fact, I actually submitted a paper about this case study to a conference, and I think an Indian reviewer said, basically, I don't believe you. Everybody in India loves technology as an economic mobility thing, right? And, you know, that's a modern middle-class urban truism. So it does cause a bit of jarring dissonance when you realize, okay, maybe people don't want this. Or maybe they would want it if they knew how to use it for something they cared about. Another picture, sort of technology entailments. I've been trying for a while to remember where this picture was taken. I'm pretty sure it's Delhi. The thing in the middle is a power pole. And the mass of wires off of it are all of the jury-rigged ad hoc connections to the power grid. It happens, this is a technology bazaar. I don't know if you can see, there's like a Duracell logo in the lower right that's pretty legible. In the upper right, there's a sign that says, Amar Video Camera Repair. Think about that, right? You talk about relationships of the technology to other things. This is a place where cameras are worth enough and labor is cheap enough and expertise is available enough that it makes sense to repair a video camera. In the U.S., that doesn't make sense. You throw it away, you get a new one, go to Best Buy. Even if you buy a Best Buy insurance policy, they'll throw it away and give you a new one. That idea of different kinds of interdependencies here, maybe one that's very non-formal in terms of people tapping informally into the power grid, pirated electricity, the idea of repairing things that maybe aren't, you know, factory authorized kinds of repair jobs, you know, that's a really important difference. You were going to say?
Yeah, in 1988, I visited China, and I was in Guangzhou, and walking out from Shamian Island, there's a big
hotel, luxury hotel of Westerner stamp, and walk down the street, and there's all these little card tables in the doorways of the shut shops. I walked over, and I saw what they were doing. They were reselling and repairing disposable Bic lighters.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, these kinds of things are hard for us in a Western culture to envision, right? And sometimes I tell these stories and people are like, oh, those poor people. And they think, we need to fix it so they don't have to pirate their power. Nobody says, wow, here's a model for crowdsourcing power that seems to be sustained at least for several decades. I mean, obviously, there's people who pay for it, and, you know, the government has to make up the slack, and the system's not very prim and proper, nor is it necessarily very safe. But this has been how power was distributed in urban India for decades. And it's a different model that we don't necessarily think about. So I wanted to, again, sort of, you know, bring us back to this idea of ecology as a metaphor for this, so that, you know, the technology exists not in isolation, but that it exists in connections, where these connections have ripple effects that are hard to necessarily imagine. I pulled the OAD definition of ecology, and I just, the second one, actually, the study of interaction of people with their environment, I thought was very interesting. I didn't realize that would have such primacy as to be a definition. But the first one, I want to highlight that word relations, because again, this relational view is exactly what we don't tend to have with technology. There's a very essentialist kind of view about technology. It has properties that make it awesome or insanely great or whatever. So this ecology as relationship idea made me think, okay, well, can we learn some things from ecology that explain situations like those parents saying no to those computers? And this is where this metaphor came up of invasive species. You know, so if we think about ecology and we think about different participants in an ecological web, one of the things that ecologists study is how ecological systems respond to the introduction of non-native species. Wasn't always seen as a negative. I mean, there was a comment about the trees, like, oh, if they're planted, it's less good than if they're old growth or natural. There, you know, it's not so long ago. How many of you actually saw the chapter that was linked from the announcement? A few. I used to live in Berkeley. I used to go walking in the Berkeley Hills. Beautiful eucalyptus trees from Australia. Right, and you would go through Tilden Park, and you'd see these plants, these beautiful plants with little plaques saying, oh, you know, this species, that species. The early 20th century naturalists were part of what they called the acclimatization movement. It was like, let's bring as many non-native species as possible and see if we can get them to flourish here, right? And that's kind of where we're at with technology. Like, let's bring as much as we can everywhere. It'll be great. You know, we love our eucalyptus trees in Australia. Let's love them in California or whatever. You know, nowadays there's still some, at least in the policy space, there's still some battle between conservation versus sustainability, the idea of trying to keep things static the way they were at a point in time. And along with that goes restoration, like taking something and putting it back the way it was. Versus people who talk about, for instance, ecological rehabilitation, or you know, the more shall we say dynamic view of sustainability as something that doesn't involve conserving something at a certain point in time. And ecologists see, you know, things like the natural progression of species in a forest. You know, goes from this to this, then this to this, then there's a forest fire, it goes back down to this, then it goes from this to this, this to this. So there's stability in dynamism in ecological systems. But invasive species kind of are a different kind of changing than these kinds of natural progressions in an ecological system. And this is a chart I lifted from a textbook where I learned everything I know about invasion ecology, Lockwood, Hoops, and Marchetti, that talks about invasion as a process. So what is an invasive species in one place is not an invasive species in another place. And it doesn't just depend on whether the species was originally or at some point in time from that place. It has more to do with what's the impact it has on the rest of the ecosystem. And they talk about invasion stages. One of the points they make is that, you know, ecological invasion happens through individual, you know, plants or animals or to use the technical term, propagules that show up in a new place. And more often than not, you bring an orchid to London and it dies, right? It's not like it's non-native, it doesn't really belong there, but it doesn't take over like kudzu, right? So this idea that these propagules go through different stages of invasion where they might die off. Can you see my mouse? You can. They might establish themselves in some permanent way or not, but maybe that permanent way is very small and self-contained. They may spread or they may remain local. Okay, it took over this little valley, but it hasn't gone anywhere else. And then it may spread, but it may have low impact, or it may have really high impact. You know, it could go both ways. And that's the point at which people start to pay attention to the invasion. What makes a species invasive? Reproduction, the numbers matter, the impact it has on the rest of the ecosystem matters. More importantly, what usually causes people to call something invasive is how much it forces the ecosystem to adapt around it. And in fact, I learned a lot from this textbook about the science behind invasive species in ecology, but there's good evidence that they are both a product of and a source of disturbance. So you're much more likely to have some non-native species take over after the forest fire that would normally cause some changes. So invasive species may step in when things are really changing. And similarly, an invasive species may cause some sort of drastic change that might be temporary, a temporary disturbance. But oftentimes what helps define an invasive species, both axiomatically and as a result of, you know, if you look at the science of non-native species and which ones, you know, establish themselves, significant changes in an ecosystem that didn't have that species before often yield brittleness. And so you end up with these monocultures or something like them where there's a really somewhat dysfunctional ecosystem. So what's that for technology? That's a picture from The Gods Must Be Crazy. People know the movie. It's just a Coke bottle, but oh, the woe it can cause. You know, the technology and the idea that it can cause impact that might cause different kinds of ecological brittleness or not is worth thinking through when we think about different kinds of technologies going from one place to another. How many of you remember microwave ovens arriving in everybody's homes, right? Changed dinner time. Family structures in America changed because of the microwave oven. You know, cell phones, right? How has that changed your ecosystem of relations to your technologies and to other people, right? There, you can look at it as a tweak that helps change the relationships between all these other things. Just another example to kind of highlight it. This is a chart produced by a nonprofit in Africa called Invinio. Or rather, I don't know if they're based in Africa. Were they? Okay. They're interested in making low-cost, low-power computers for developing countries, because this chart, what it shows is total cost of ownership, and the red and the green are costs of power infrastructure and gas. And on the far right are donated PCs, and on the far left are their brand new things that are low power and, you know, can be powered by solar or low-cost local power supplies. And so, you know, when you say, oh, here's a free computer, that's great, but that has entailments, like we need to get a lot of electricity to it. Or, like the computers in India, they needed power, they also needed sort of community knowledge, they needed goodwill, they needed training, they needed, you know, textbooks to teach people what to do in the local language. They needed content, right? Those CD-ROMs, they were one of a very small batch of CD-ROMs being produced by a nonprofit in Bangalore, but there's just not that much online educational material in Hindi at that time, and getting it to the kids in a form when they didn't have the internet, like, you know, that's an entailment. You need stuff to go with it. Okay. I'm going to speed things up a little bit so that we can maybe have more conversation. But I just want to highlight some places where this analogy falls down. If you talk about invasive species in the ecological sense, the idea of propagules, the idea of dependencies, the idea of range, you know, the range of a particular species, those translate pretty well to the idea of technologies. I mean, the range, again, there are ecological niches, like you remember the Juicy Fruit IMAX sort of helping make computers make the leap from offices to homes, you know, or accelerating that leap that was already taking place. The idea of competition and displacement with other species or other technologies, very true. IM flourished in North America more than in Europe, where people already had SMS, you know. Disruption and equilibrium, we can totally wrap our heads around how that would apply to both. Where it starts to fall down is these last three bullets. So in the ecological sense, we talk about species reproduction, we talk about environmental brittleness or resilience, and we talk about evolution. And in the technology space, what is reproduction of the species that is a cell phone? I mean, do I even call it a cell phone if it's, you know, a smartphone that's different from the... Is that a subspecies? Is that a new species? Is reproduction when people adopt it? The idea of technological brittleness, you know, we don't necessarily have the same kinds of definitions as we might in an ecological sense. And then this idea of evolution. What is the evolution of these things in their ecology? What does that mean? What does it look like in the analogy? And in particular, what's a native technology? I love... I just happened to Google, designed in or where designed in, something like that. And, of course, what comes up, two images of Apple products, one showing... designed by Apple in California, they put on every box. And on the other hand, this graphic that had been put on a blog about made in Korea. And so, you know, our devices, where they're native, is kind of hard to say. Like, is the native habitat of a tower PC a westernized cubicle? You know, like, what's the ecological niche of different technologies? And it's clearly, especially given global supply chains, it's clearly not the physical geography of where the device comes from. But we do have things that fit and things that don't fit, and so where they're native to may have more to do about where they're appropriate or where they exist happily, where they reproduce, whatever we think that means. So, you know, desktop machines have moved around the world, but at one point Intel had a great, I just love the title of this. They had a research project going called The Next Billion, because the desktop computing platform had reached roughly 1 out of 7 billion people on the planet, and they wanted to figure out why it was kind of plateauing. On the other hand, you know, we've crossed 3 billion in the mobile side, and it just keeps growing. Right, so penetration of one technology is spreading like crazy. One kind of spread and then it stopped. OLPC is another example. Like, where is OLPC native to? And you know, I'm a fan of technology in service of local needs in developing countries, but I'm really concerned about OLPC because I go to a village in India and they're like 4 televisions in the village connected to motorcycle batteries. But when there's a cricket match, everybody gathers in one home to watch the TV together to have a shared experience, because that's very culturally sensible. And then somebody comes in and says there has to be one laptop per child. You know, and on and on. You can talk about different ways that we could define nativeness to say where is the native habitat of the OLPC XO laptop. Kinkajou is another example. It's similar heritage, came from ideas at the Media Lab, spun out into a nonprofit called Design That Matters. They were thinking they were going to do laptops for literacy. They worked with a bunch of, I want to say, East African NGOs doing literacy education and evolved their design, where what they ended up with was a projector, low-power projector with LED lights, lenses donated by, low-cost optics donated by Mattel, sealed with a microfilm inside of 10,000 pages worth of vetted literacy materials, for which there was already an infrastructure because these NGOs already had trainers who'd been working with those materials. They were thinking laptop-y, isn't that great to have something generic? But then you start seeing the entailments, and this particular design trajectory ended up in a really different place than the OLPC design trajectory. I have visited some of the OLPC field sites in Nepal, and I talked to some of the kids, and they're like, we love having textbooks. That's why we love our computers, because we can read our textbooks on them, and we can't get the textbooks otherwise. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a political failure, as opposed, because cost-wise, it's way cheaper to send the books than the computers. Mm-hmm. But computers draw aid, and textbooks don't. I don't know. You know, there's entailments, right? So...
Well, it's not really cheap. It depends how many textbooks you're sending. So,
that's right.
But, nearly infinite number of textbooks on the computer, that's a lot more expensive.
That's right. And it also depends on how many people are expected to use a device or to share a device. I mean, one of the things that's pretty common in these pilot projects is people share devices in ways that other people might get angry about it. Like, no, this is supposed to be for the kids. You're not supposed to, like, and next thing you know, the father's taking it to the marketplace and, you know, using it for something completely different. Like, there's secondary, tertiary, quaternary effects that are hard to predict. So, in the spirit of that, like, evolution, like, what makes a species successful without being invasive, I'm trying to think through what this means, indigenous design, and hopefully we can have some conversation about that. I'm moving on time. I'll be a little faster. We have done some experiments trying to do something that's a little more design in context. So working with that NGO in Uttarakhand that did the fancy regression, they had some projects with this group that was doing environmental education after school, again, talking about relations. This is a poster that's up in that facility. The top says, our government education, publicly provided education. There's a triangle with community, teacher, student, and it has a two-way arrow between teacher and student. I would argue it's even one way. And then below that, it says needed education, and it has a triangle where all three are having relations in bidirectional arrows. I went there thinking I was going to be the outsider coming to do something really useful with internet technologies, and I got schooled. And they were like, that's unrealistic, and here's why. And so what we ended up doing was using some technologies that were much more locally appropriate, in particular video cameras. Low power consumption, easy to carry out if they need repair. And boy, you get awesome bandwidth with DV tapes on milk trucks. Like, you can get a lot of bits from one place to another. So we had kids making documentaries of local environmental issues and then sharing them out with their community. That picture on the right is a battery-powered television borrowed from somebody's house. We actually had the videos dubbed and translated and then shared them between similar villages in India and Nepal so they could kind of see different reactions to similar ecological challenges. Another experiment, we've been trying to do design work with a group called Play Power. Play Power, OLPC is like the $100 laptop, except it really costs $300-$400. The Play Power platform, you see it in the picture on the left. It's $10, and you can buy it in any bazaar in any developing country. It is a pirated version of the original Nintendo. It runs cartridges. It plugs into an analog television set. It comes with some game pads, a keyboard, and if you're lucky, this one actually has a light gun. Remember Duck Hunt? And so Play Power was a nonprofit started by a couple grad students out of San Diego to develop educational software for this platform. But what they needed was an ecosystem to produce that. And so these pictures, the picture in the upper left was a workshop we ran at NYU. It turns out a lot of people with expertise in developing for this ancient platform are 8-bit chip music artists. So, I mean, there are people like me of a certain age who learned 6502 assembly language, but we don't remember it, and these guys do. So they came, they helped run a workshop. We brought in all these game designers who were really interested. But you also see on the right me with the lead student. He's an undergrad in Ahmedabad, India. They ran a similar workshop in India, Play Power did, and they have a staff now of essentially 20 or so computer science undergrads who are working on developing content and software, and they're doing way more than the volunteers in the U.S. at this point. The whole thing is volunteer-run. They got a MacArthur grant to start, but that didn't pay for any game development. And what you see in the bottom is the first working game to come out of this collaboration, Hanuman Typing Warrior. And it's based on the Hindu story of Hanuman getting this special herb from this mountain to save Lakshmi, but he can't find the herb, so he gets the whole mountain, picks it up, and brings it back with him. The kids learn how to type by playing this game. Typing sounds like a really stupid learning goal, but, again, locally appropriate. Typing skills are the difference between earning a dollar an hour and a dollar a day. Very relevant. So, this was another project we did. This is a group of bureaucrats from the Ministry of Education and the Ministry of Science and Technology of the government of Nepal playing with their first iPhone. We did these participatory design workshops with different stakeholder groups around what kinds of ed tech platforms might make sense in Nepal. OLPCs, Kindles, toys from LeapFrog, smartphones, Pico projectors, flip cams, like everything in sort of that price point of $200 to $400. We did a similar workshop with undergrads in engineering at Kathmandu University. And then finally, we did a workshop with youth in a village at a very special community technology center in Nepal called YMRC Sanku. It's a youth-managed resource center. And so this is a technology center that does all kinds of local economic and social development, not just technology stuff. The computers are their kind of core, but they do health trainings out in the villages, that kind of thing. And they agreed to help me do a participatory design activity. We brought the gadgets, and these kids, and they are kids who run the center, took my backpack full of gadgets for 2 weeks, got themselves up to speed on them with some help from me, but mostly by themselves. And then they created an exhibition. So what you see at the right is they've created explanatory placards to go with each one. They gathered up a bunch of kids to bring them into the center to have them go around and see these different technologies. Because, again, even though it's a technology center, they have a hard time getting permission to get the girls to be able to leave the home to come to the center to take a computer training. Like, it's not like everybody can just use computers there now that they have this center. So the idea was they wanted to train the kids up on what the possibilities were before we started these design activities. This is some work we've been doing in Ghana on climate change, and I won't say more about it other than that this is technology-free, but it's the other half of the problem, which is measuring resilience. So we're trying to come up with ways to measure what does it mean to have an information system that's resilient as opposed to brittle. And just kind of to sum up. Do you want me to say more?
Yeah.
The project is called Anticipatory Learning in Climate Change Adaptation and Resilience. It's a partnership with geographers, climate scientists, a landscape architect who's an expert in community-based ecological rehabilitation, adult participatory action researchers, and me, working on information flow and learning in response to climate change. That's reactive learning. And then to what extent are there ways to measure the nimbleness of a community in learning ahead of time So is there any planning process? Do people have the kind of social capital that gives them access to information about new ideas or about future trends? Are there ways that that we can see redundancies, for instance, in not just safety networks of economic resilience, which are pretty well studied, but also information resilience, and where are people getting their information so that they can think about the future with respect to climate change? And in the case of this idea of if we want to do non-invasive technology design, we need to also think about ways to measure are we impacting the resilience or the brittleness of the systems that we're hitting. So this is a picture of these kids with a video camera. Yeah, there's the technology. That's the part that, you know, got us the funding. But the project, you know, was about the natural environment. This is also, you can't really see it well in this picture, but that's garbage on the floor. The human environment and the stairs going off to the house next door and the community. And, you know, these local relationships are not predictable. I mean, lots of unanticipated consequences. So the design processes that have to address them are hard. And if it's designed in California, will it work in, you know, New Delhi? Or will I have to buy a voltage stabilizer and, you know, put woven, I've seen the most beautiful textiles used as computer drapes to keep the dust out when the computer's not in use, right? Like, what are the entailments? And, you know, some of these voltage stabilizers that I see in places like India, they're made by local people out of, you know, there's a transformer, there's, you know, some wires and resistors, and they put it in a wooden box. It's totally indigenous. The adaptation part was indigenous in that case. But they have no access to say, how could I design a desktop from the ground up to fit this context? And that's something that I think is kind of the take-home message is we need ways to get capacity for that, you know, because if it's all a black box and the only people who control it are big media and big tech, you know, if I need to be Intel to make a design decision, then we have no evolution. You know, you can have adaptation, you can use things a different way, but you can't create the technologies that are locally relevant. And these are some exciting examples. Maker Faire is coming up real soon in New York. You all should go. It's awesome. They started in California. The second one was in Africa. Then it spread to Detroit, then New York. Now they're running, I think, also in England. But the Maker Faire is like people hacking shit and kids getting excited about making things and voiding warranties and doing all kinds of things their parents probably get nervous about. Yeah.
There's a Maker Faire in Providence last weekend.
Oh, are they in Massachusetts now? Or Rhode Island?
Yeah.
In Rhode Island, okay. Designers
having their conference, I think, this weekend or next weekend in Providence.
It's pretty cool. I think, you know, the moment is right. Last year's Maker Faire in New York, there was a summit organized by the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, basically getting all the STEM education people together to say, you need to be paying attention to this Maker Faire thing, and you've never seen such a humorous sight as a bunch of crufty, schoolish professors wandering through this fair where they quite literally had an exhibit that was a carnival ride that had been built with an Army surplus rocket, and it was so loud that they had to call the New York Hall of Science is right near LaGuardia Airport. They had to call Homeland Security and tell them, no, really, it's okay. That we have this thing here, this big flaming steel rocket ride thing. You know, it's not our normal way of thinking of inventiveness, but it's a place where innovations can come from. The other two examples on this slide, lower right, UNICEF runs an innovations lab in Kosovo. It's all about participatory design of technologies. Lots of exciting stuff coming out of that. Up in the upper right is the Open Technologies Resource Center in Nepal. And boy, you've never seen such a dedicated group of hacker weenies making cool things, ranging from a port of Linux into Nepali, to radio programs nationwide about computers and what they're good for, to a kiosk where you can come and bring a blank disk and burn yourself some Linux because you don't have the bandwidth to easily download it. Right? Like, just amazing kinds of indigenous innovation. Pardon, the left one? So lower left is the upcoming Maker Faire in Cairo. I think it's the fourth Maker Faire for Africa. They've done west, east, south, and now they'll do North Africa. Yeah?
I was talking to some of the people who are involved in the April 5th movement in Egypt,
mm-hmm.
and trying to say, okay, there's a lot of this stuff which is involved in economics as well as politics and social. And
yeah.
there is appropriate technology, there's sustainability. If you use social media the same way that you use to organize for Tahrir Square,
yeah.
to do job development, sustainability, appropriate technology, and all of those things,
yeah.
it can jump off enormously. Yeah. And hopefully the Cairo Maker Faire will be part of that.
I hope so. It's exciting. There's my favorite Hindi word. There's this awesome word, jugad. Which means kind of a kludge. Maybe that's the best translation. I'm not. It's hard to translate. But the idea is just a sort of spit and chewing gum kind of solution to something where you just cobble something together. And that level of innovation is not necessarily present when you think about non-traditional contexts, whether it's Africa or Detroit. And I grew up in Flint. Man, that's a place that needs some serious innovation, and where sustainability has a lot to do with self-reliance because, government's tapped out. They can't help you, really. There's only so much that can be done to save Detroit. If the people there find a way to make it work, then that's a really different thing. My working definition at the moment of indigenous design is this kind of evolution of technologies in context through a design process. But I'm not 100% clear on what that means on the ground or how we might gauge it differently than some of these other things that happen, like propagules taking root or not. Which is a better metaphor, I don't know. That's all my slides.
Existing institutions like the Peace Corps, other would take this kind of concept and implement it among the other kinds of projects and within its mission.
No, I mean it's funny when I think about what are the barriers to doing it. The biggest barrier is believing you can. I mean, I still remember when I got to college, I was taking an electrical engineering class, and my friend went to Radio Shack and built a project. And I had been studying equations that, told me about how to model the circuitry and all this stuff, but I did what I was told. And I wasn't improvising, and I wasn't thinking outside the lines, and he was. And I remember that being a really sort of, sea change kind of moment. So that moment is part of the equation. And some of it is who's threatened, right? Like, Sony gets mad when you hack their IBOs sometimes. Microsoft gets mad when you hack their Xbox sometimes.
But they didn't get mad when people hacked Kinect.
Pardon? They
didn't get mad when people hacked Kinect.
No, they did, and then they realized that they weren't going to win that battle.
Yeah.
And now they've gone along with it, and I think that changes the model.
Well, and this idea of who's threatened by what kinds of design is worth asking. It's not, if it's important, it's dangerous. So to somebody, and there are forces that will prevent this from happening. I personally think one of the big forces is lack of venues or training knowledge that helps you spread around the wisdom of the person who figured out how to cobble together the whatever to the whatever. But so the NGO I work with there actually has a program now that was grassroots driven. They didn't come up with it. The communities requested it. But they do basically focus groups / support groups of youth, i.e. People after 10th grade but before marriage, who want to stay in the village of where they might do for jobs. Well, it depends on how big a shortage of men there is. But the idea of things like doing farming or other kinds of business models, they have talked a little bit about technology. It's not like, oh, let's open a call center. It's like, oh, maybe I can help, you know, my neighbors keep their books, or maybe I can, you know, a lot of it, that's actually a real small minority, though. Most of it is like, wow, I can make jams out of these, you know, products, and then I can do it in big batches a little more efficiently than my friends and neighbors will. That NGO has a very strong preference to support efforts that are more self-contained and less part of globalized economies. So the usual aid model is, let's get the women making crafts and we'll sell them on the internet to rich people in the West. And these guys are more like, let's get people making things that people here use. So, you know, technology sometimes enters into that, but there are limits to what they can do, and some of that is their particular, you know, economic resources, but a lot of it is knowledge resources.
I want to mention two references that are connected. If you haven't seen it, Stephen Jackson at University of Michigan has this great paper on Things Fall Apart, Rural Namibia Study. It's like just really reads a lot of what you're saying. Another example that's from not the ecology context, but from development context, which had made a great impression on me, is my friend Palugami Sainath in India had written this book called Everybody Loves a Good Drought, where they imported these Holland cows to Andhra Pradesh, where the cows just died out. But before importing the cows, to make sure that the cows wouldn't be accidentally impregnated by the local population, they killed all the bulls. So when the Holland cows also died, a state which was milk producing became milk deficit. And this is no joke, you know, this is like people living on subsistence levels, so this probably caused lots of kid deaths because you have, you know, less milk, infant mortality. And so there is, it's the same story. And I do digital divide, I've been involved in digital divide stuff for a long time in grad school. We would, one of the things I did in one summer was to go to rural Texas libraries when they were first installing sort of broadband in libraries, computer centers. And the same complaint came up. People were looking up jobs to get out of there. And the community was like, they weren't sure. The people, you know, but that was the first thing people would do, is to use this connection. So those are just three, couple of references that I want to mention. But here's my question. I'm from Turkey. And it's not that good yet. We're moving a little bit into the black box model where you throw things away. But it's still, everything does get fixed. And I regularly take stuff back, because I hate throwing away. And like my 88-year-old grandmother will attack a microwave with a screwdriver because the fuse was blown. Here, everybody will just throw it away. And over time, I've been thinking about how that kind of local know-how is actually not a bad idea here, because the throw-thing-away model is based on the assumption you have infinite resources, which is obviously not the case. And it also is based on the idea that you can always outsource this labor someplace else cheaper, which then you have the jobs problem here. If, you know, some of these sort of the maker fair, the kind of knowledge, if they produce lower powered stuff that kids can break, it might even be good to learn from them. In fact, I work on youth a little, and increasingly to them, the computer is just a black box. And that's sort of the, you know, for the current digital native, they really have a much, like when I was growing up, I had to figure stuff out to be able to connect. Now, they don't have to do any of that, and they don't have to hack anything, and they don't have, it's like what you were describing with that. Yeah. So I'm actually thinking, you know, not just wondering about how to help them, kind of that kind of approach to, can we make this lower powered? Can we make this cheaper? Can we fix this?
Yeah.
And what do you
I wish there was a curriculum for this, right?
Like bringing it back here, you know?
Yeah. I have a friend who, he runs a center in Northern California, coastal California, and it's basically a science, it claims to be an ecology center, but it's basically a fun play science type of maker place where you try to make and remake things. They have, in part because of the garbage issue, you know, that's part of their motivation for doing this, because it's not economically, you know, blenders are so cheap, it doesn't make sense to spend hours and hours and hours fixing one. But for the kids, it's kind of fun, and they feel like they're saving something from landfill, or they can invent something, whatever. But he's also done work in East Timor, trying to come up with curriculum for their science K-12 education. And in particular, they decided the best way to make it relevant to local populations, the teachers who helped co-design this curriculum all tried to relate it all to local habits and practices, which are, in many cases, about conserving resources or reusing resources in some way. And I wish we had something like that for Detroit, frankly. So let's make one.
Really quickly, so I'm teaching at the Civic Media Center down the street, and I actually am going to be teaching in the spring a course on collaborative design of civic media. So I'm right now, this week, building a curriculum, which I have to submit by the 15th, so I'd love to talk to you about it.
Yeah.
As you know, there's a whole series of different histories and trajectories of participatory design, everything from, you know, after decolonization, there was the whole appropriate technology movement, to there are Scandinavian firms that have human-centered design, to there's, you know, there's many converging histories of approaches to design that involve the communities of use at every stage of the design process.
Right.
It's becoming more sort of visible now. So I'm building that now, and I'd love to hear your thoughts
on
it.
Cool. I'm keen to talk.
I noticed that
I'm not an economist, just for the record.
Fair enough, I'm not really either. But I did notice that that the entities who are working on indigenous design that you talked about were all NGOs, as far as I could tell. And I guess my question is, you know, why isn't the private sector driving this, in the sense that, you know, if somebody comes up with a good gadget that works in rural India, right, then presumably it would work in rural Africa as well and other parts of rural India. So what is the barrier to some of these indigenous innovators getting financing or partnership
I really wish I knew. I mean, this is a problem I've been thinking about. So I work with, in Nepal, I work with a group called Environmental Camps for Conservation Awareness. And they were originally, they had this great model that was an educational model where they would get world-class experts, some Nepali, some international, to work with college students who would then go out into schools and run eco-clubs and usually summer camps where they would have kids do some kind of local environmental project. So they have a paid staff of like 4, but they have an impact of tens of thousands of kids that they run through their programs. But they tried to branch out into some appropriate technology stuff. They actually tried to create a self-sustaining social entrepreneurship thing around solar lanterns. They used local electrical engineers, Chinese parts. They designed up something, came up with a funding scheme, you know, so the family could pay what they were normally paying for kerosene to get the solar lantern, and they would pay it for long enough that it would pay back the cost of the solar lantern and then some to grow the program. And it kind of fell apart, and I think part of it is that it's just really hard to do business in a place where the infrastructure is kind of crappy, and it's also partly that these are the wrong people to do it. And so I had a conversation with a friend who was the lead on the next billion project at Intel. I'm like, well, what would it take? You know, what would it take? And he's like, oh, you got to think about distribution. And then, oh, and you got to think about manufacturing. And you got to think about, and we started getting into some stuff, and we had this interesting conversation about, like, well, you know, he's saying prototyping is really expensive, even just building the case. Like, it costs this much. I'm like, I can get people to whittle a case out of wood. So let's, like, that scales down. He's like, you need to run at least 100. And so I think that's part of the issue is the size of, like, as much as there's a concept of appropriate technology, there's not necessarily a concept of appropriate technology business or entrepreneurship. And maybe it needs things that don't exist. But I am so bad at, I'm a do-gooder who doesn't worry about things monetary as much as would be necessary to actually do more good. So.
An anthropological team that travels around the world to figure out, for example, that cell phones in Bangladesh need a hook because you want to hang them on the wall, and whenever it floods, you know, you're still okay. Microsoft down here on Memorial Drive has a whole team working on the anthropology of the interface because they want to figure out, you know, how do we reach the non-readers in the third world, You need glare on the screen, okay, or you have glare on the screen, the third one, okay, so you can't just move it on to all visual stuff. It's got to be sound, maybe. You know, they're working on these things because it really, there's a huge market in mobile in particular. So whenever they can see the money, they absolutely go in.
The big companies are beginning to pay attention in that way. And the question is, what is a small company in the cell phone space? Like, you know.
There's a company called Celco, Solar Electric Light Company in India, which has been successful developing solar electric lights for shopkeepers on the same kind of model, you know, daily payment instead of for kerosene for the solar electric light. And they've been successful. So would it be possible to have a network of these developing world companies, which have been successful in doing the appropriate technology, reaching out to other companies to do it? What was interesting when I heard from Celco is that a few years ago, when the German solar input fee, so you know they were paying people to put PV on the roof, dried up their market. They couldn't get PV panels, so it was affecting people in India that Germany was boosting solar. So. It's a globalized and complex system.
Somebody pick with you, and then.
I'm thinking of your use of the words invasive and non-invasive, and of you kind of. It seems like you're kind of implying that it would be non-invasive if it were designed in the actual place in which it was being used, and. I guess I'm kind of wondering, about the way we've been talking about the Western world versus other communities. And when I think about the U.S., for example, I think, well, there are a ton of diverse communities. So I can think of areas in which there are still TV repair shops and VCR repair shops in the U.S.
Yeah.
Which then makes me wonder about this village in India. It makes me wonder about the diversity that is there in India. And I guess just wondering about the fine line, I guess, between fetishizing some indigenous technology or some non-westernized ways of living. And I guess for you, I guess what type of questions do you ask yourself, what types of assumptions do you try to check so that we're not entering that realm where progress may be impeded, where maybe there is a real question about whether or not people should stay in the village or go to the city. Maybe it's not a foregone conclusion that everyone should stay there.
Right. And that, I think it's funny, that question, especially the whether people stay in the village question, is one that I get very frequently in India itself, often from groups of people who have a very strong opinion about the right answer, but not always the same right answer.
Right.
And it raises passions in a big way. And I try to be humble about this. Obviously, I'm bringing my own worldview to bear on things. But you know, the question of if it's designed locally, does that make it somehow good? The way that if it's an old growth forest, it's somehow inherently better than if it was planted. And sometimes planted things work better. You know, sometimes you're doing, you know, rehabilitation on an ecosystem, or you're helping an ecosystem adapt that's just not sustainable anymore in its current form. And similarly, I think, you know, I don't want to have to try to walk in the door and say, you should make these choices because this is good for you, because that's exactly what I keep seeing breaks. But the question is, if you get more design capacity locally, can you mutually come up with solutions that are more sustainable? And, you know, obviously I have my own value set that I bring to bear. I try not to be a jerk about it. It's really hard. I mean, I'll tell you, one of the hardest things for me to deal with personally was like the entire set of issues around arranged marriages. You know, and I lived in India for a year, and my friends had arranged marriages, and sometimes I saw it as, you know, something that was happening in a way that seemed like a culturally different practice that was wow, that's different, and it seems to work, and everybody's happy with it, okay. And in other places, I saw things happening where I really just felt like I'm witnessing oppression, and people are being harmed, and I have to say something, but who am I? You know, and yeah, I don't think there's an easy answer. The one, you know, I got asked this question at Microsoft, too. The one answer I can give is that I try my darndest to figure these things out through friendships. Like, I have not been a researcher who can really do much in a flyby kind of study, and I have friends who collect data much more rapidly. And I just, partly out of personal preference and partly out of my own work style, I just can't. I have to work through longer-term relationships. So usually I have somebody who's a friend in the place that I can trust and turn to help me think through these issues, and hopefully the people that I'm working with all become friends sooner or later so I can work through those issues. But it doesn't always happen. You know, I do my best.
You may want to not use the word invasive then.
Well, although I do, I think there's merit in identifying, obviously this is an analogy, this is not a perfect analogy, but it's an analogy to a phenomenon that gets discussed in ecology. And in ecology, there is an important difference between ecosystems change and what they call invasive species. And there are competing definitions about what defines an invasive species, but there are certain negative implications of it that are intentionally negative and based on what you see happening. Like, for instance, ecological dominance within the system, increasing the brittleness, displacement of other species. There's a whole chapter in this textbook I was reading about resource consumption. So in general, when an invasive species enters an ecosystem, it's much more likely that the soil is going to get depleted in a way that may not be sustainable in the long run. So there's a burnout kind of trajectory for these things. And so, you know, if we do have technological species that are maybe going through an invasion process, then I think it's okay to label it as bad, like, you know. But we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater and say that all change is bad and everybody should be an Amish person. And, you know, I that's not fair to us. It would be especially not fair if we were to tell that to someone in a developing country.
I just have two points to make. One is, if you are going to go about developing a curriculum around this, I would say the most important thing you could tell a group of students to do is to try to develop something for a community locally.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you have kids here who think that they're going to design programs that are going to change India and Africa, and they're afraid to go to Dorchester.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, if you work with a community they would tell you, because they speak your language, what you're doing wrong. And I think I think to some extent, this like idea of ICT4D is really missing, the people who tell you no, this isn't going to work.
And yeah.
Sort of to that point, I find it really interesting that there's such a disconnect between what you labeled correctly as a high level of local expertise, the people who fix video cameras, the people who fix computers. Why are those people not being tapped by the NGOs who are going in and being empowered, right? I mean, there was a point in European history when technologists were not thought of as innovators. They were thought of as craftsmen, right? Uh-huh. They built these tools that people used, and they weren't thought of as creators. And I think that's where a lot of the technologists in third world countries are now. And like, you should go to them and say, you know, you can fix a video camera. You can also design something from scratch. Yeah. And it really seems like we should be targeting that. And, you know, that becomes a point of resource to tell NGOs, here's local knowledge on both sides.
Yeah, and some of that is having clear marching orders, like having clear goals about what we want to fix in our community or what we want to... I mean, interestingly, this NGO, I feel like I've learned most of what I know about systemic issues from the Uttarakhand Sevanidhi. They, their very first action when they encounter a new village, at this point, it's the case that they never approach anyone, people approach them. But they get approached by a village, and the first thing they do is kind of assess, like, do you have decision-making capacity? Do you have a way to come up with a community vision? Not do you have one ready at hand, but do you even have a venue to talk about these things and come to something that you can all work towards? And, I think that's one of those things that is lacking in that exact situation you're talking about. Because there's innovation in the sense of like, oh, there's some new video camera out and the guy's got to reverse engineer how to fix that one, right? But that's reactive innovation. It's not goal-driven. It's not towards the values of the local community necessarily, other than having a working video camera.
But then it seems like the thing you should be teaching is design, not necessarily technological capability.
They have to go together. Right. Yeah. Cool. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Chris.